Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm your host today, Cynthia McClure, along with Pat Schlarbaum and Kay Puttock. Hello, Pat. Hello, Kay.
Hello, Cynthia and Kay. And hello to you, the KHOI listeners. We have a great show today. Bob Anderson with the Decorah Eagle Cam is willing to provide a phone interview and some updates on the Eagles, and we'll probably have some event, Bald Eagle event updates later on in the program.
Pat, I believe the Eagles have made a comeback partly because of the practice of using pesticides that damages their eggs has been at least reined in. Specifically, I think it's thanks to Rachel Carson, maybe.
Yes,
Silent Spring.
It is. Yeah.
The use of DDT, a pesticide that's had a devastating effect on the eggs, has been curtailed. They still use it a bit, don't they, DDT?
Worldwide.
Yeah.
It has been banned since 1972 in the United States.
But pesticide drift, general pesticide drift, is still a problem, particularly in an agricultural state like Iowa. And we'll be hearing more about that from one of our guests today, who represents the Iowa Farmers Union, or IFU. That's Gabrielle. Welcome, Gabrielle.
Thank you for having me.
The Iowa Farmers Union leads the coalition that filed a petition in December with the Iowa Department of Agriculture asking for new rules around pesticide application. And we'll be hearing more about the proposed rules and how they'll help the problem later in our program.
We'll also be hearing from Jasmine Margia, an intern here at KHOI, who interviewed two Iowa State students from Ferguson, Missouri, about their experiences growing up in that community. Jared Ingram is a junior studying kinesiology, and Kendra White is a senior studying chemistry, and they both run for the Iowa State track team. Belinda will also give us an end-of-the-week rundown on where you can hear live music and entertainment here in Central Iowa.
So you are listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and Bob Anderson is on the line. Bob is the Decorah Eagle Cam steward and has devoted his life to the betterment of not only eagles, but all raptors, birds of prey that the eagles occupy. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning, Pat.
Well, it's just so great to hear your voice and have you included this morning. How are the Decorah Eagles doing today?
Well, last night we had quite a few visits by horned owls, great horned owls, to the nest. And in fact, it almost looked like an egg was laid, but it wasn't. One of the adult owls was actually making a bowl in the nest, and every time it got up, you expected to see that little egg, and it wasn't there. So that's good, I guess. But
So the owls
right
like
now we've got a battle. We've got great horned owls in the nest at night, and during the day we've got bald eagles. So quite for sure who's going to win the battle.
And the great horned owls, they look for a platform, apparently. And that eagle nest has been deemed appropriate for their... Now, this is the second nest that the eagles constructed?
Well, it's actually this pair's third nest. 8 years ago, a nest on top of the bluff went down. Then they moved down to Willard Holthouse's backyard. And then 3 years ago, it started building a nest 300 feet away. Bald eagles are compulsive nest builders. We have another one here in Decorah that built two nests in one tree. Both of them collapsed, and now they've built a third nest in a poplar tree, of all things, which is assured to collapse.
Oh, gee, I guess for the listeners, when they add to these nests each year, there's ice and water accumulation. Eventually, all the nests will come down. It's just kind of a fact of life with the when they're putting them in trees. So a backup nest is always good. So you're having visitation from great horned owls. Is this kind of early for there to be great horned owls to be nesting?
Well, no, great horned owls nest actually quite early in the year. But this is the first time that we've ever confirmed great horned owls at, you know, the Decorah Bald Eagle Nest. And there's kind of a battle taking place. One of the owls last week actually knocked one of the eagles right off the nest.
Wow.
So it was pretty impressive to see that. It really was. Yeah. At first I thought, well, the bald eagles are about three times larger than the great horned owls, and surely they'll win the battle, but maybe not. You know, the great horned owl, another name, Tiger of the Air, is pretty formidable, and so, you know, the jury's out now. We might have a Decorah great horned owl cam this year.
Well, life will unfold. What are the weights of great horned owls compared to a bald eagle?
Probably the average weight is about, you know, 3 pounds for a great horned owl and 9 to 10 pounds for a bald eagle.
So the tiger of the night skies is pretty formidable. And is that a disadvantage for the bald eagles at nighttime when they're...
Well, we do know that the bald eagles can and do sometimes fly at night, and they're capable of coming and going from the nest and sometimes even feeding at night. They don't have the vision that the horned owls do. So last week, the adult male owl never saw it coming when he got struck by the by the adult female great horned owl.
Sure. It's and it's worth pointing out that your research, your cameras, your those the night camera particularly, has exhibited things that to the rest of the biological world was unknown.
That's a marvelous thing about it. I mean, the bald eagle has been studied a lot. It's our national emblem, but it's so fun to learn new things. I mean, to discover that they come and go at night and that they sometimes bring food in at night was, I think, it was an unknown, and it took our infrared cameras to show these behaviors.
Well, it sure has. And from this work, let's focus on your migrant youngster, if you will, the 3.5-year-old. D1, do you know his location these days?
No, we don't. D1's transmitter worked for 3.5 years, and it shut off last June and never turned back on. So we don't even know if he's alive, you know, if D1's alive now. But we did get 3 years of magnificent data. I mean, who would ever guess that an Iowa eagle would winter? I mean, spend the summer in Polar Bear Provincial Park every year. I mean, that was just, amazing to see.
Where there's
that.
No,
I mean,
trees, by the way.
Yeah, it's above the tree line, high in the Arctic, even where, you know, the ice on Hudson Bay that doesn't go out until July. You know, so it's, you know, we're hoping that, that she's alive, and maybe it was a transmitter failure, and now it's caused me to look at every single eagle I see to see if it's got a transmitter on it, to see if I can, you know, tell if D1 is alive. In fact, people came here last fall from all around the country and searched all the different places that D1 was known to, you know, habitat when she was, and hang around when she was in this area of the state, and of course, sadly, she was not confirmed. We did not see her. So,
well,
we do have a transmitter on a bird from last year, though. The only bird that's really survived from last year, one bird you might recall was electrocuted, another bird had a broken wing, and the third bird was quite in trouble quite a bit. It got trapped in corn, so after about, you know, 2 weeks on wing, and it got in trouble, we decided to put a transmitter on it. If we wouldn't have put a transmitter on that bird, she would have died, because there were many times that we just had to, you know, wrestle her out of, one time she was stuck in a woven fence, and would have never gotten out if I wouldn't have tracked her down and found her. So, but today now, she's, now for the last 2 months, she's been living just south of Cedar Rapids, and everything's going well. So maybe we do have one survivor from this last breeding season.
Right, and that D1 was returning to the Decorah era each winter. As you mentioned, people were looking for it. People keep an eye out for that D1. Quite a story. Now, there was an injured bird that's over at Kay Newman's Saving Our Avian Resources. We featured her on different programs at different times. I understand that's going to be a educational eagle now.
Correct. It had a broken wing that the break was real close to a joint, which is never good for when you're trying to fix a bird's wing. So the bird, will never be able to fly again, but it's going to be used for education and be representative probably of, the Decorah eagle cams forevermore.
Right. It's our educational ambassador now. It is it's something that does happen. And also you mentioned that you were hoping that D1, the one that had the transmitter for 3.5 years, that's quite remarkable that it survived its first year, I understand. The majority of eagles just don't hardly make it through their first year, statistically.
Yeah, so, the first year in all wildlife is pretty tough. If you can survive your first year, then you stand a pretty good chance of living till old age. But the first year weeds out a lot of, animals and small birds and just all wildlife. It's pretty tough. If you don't have everything, all the moxie it takes to survive, you're culled from the breeding pool.
Right, yeah. Well, Bob, it's still a fascinating year, with or without the presence of the great horned owls. We'll be watching your nesting activities, and it's sure good to have. Is there anything else you'd like to include here with us this morning?
Well, only that, we are now looking at creating a second Decorah Eagle Cam, so to make sure that we have at least one for the public. It's obvious that the world has fallen in love with the Decorah Eagle Cam, but some things like this, like a couple of years ago, they built a new nest, and now we have owls that might display some. So I think in order for us to always have a Decorah Eagle Cam, we're going to have to probably wire up a second nest. And so I'm moving in that direction.
Yeah.
And we're also looking at turning all of our cameras into high def this year. We're going to be making the jump from analog cameras to high def, so the video quality should just only get better
Oh my gosh. And that video quality of your Decorah Eagle Cam, it's just amazing with being able to see every feather. Yeah, thanks for all you're doing for not only bald eagles, but peregrine falcons, all the raptors, all the community of Decorah. You've really shined a light on a portion of Iowa that is being shared with the world. Bob Anderson.
Thank you, Pat.
Yeah. And we're going to be coming up, you know, to Prairie du Chien on February the 21st. There'll be a bald eagle event there at Prairie du Chien that you'll be involved with, I'm sure. And also February 22nd will be at Sailorville. So we want the listeners to know that we've got some upcoming bald eagle events here in central Iowa. Des Moines, the 13th and 14th of February, and then Sailorville on the 22nd. So there's plenty of bald eagle interest, and it's just great to have you with us, Bob Anderson. Thank you.
Thank you, Pat.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in central Iowa. I'm one of your hosts today, Cynthia McClure, and we were just listening to Pat Schlarbaum and Bob Anderson's report on the Decorah Eagle Cam and the health of our eagle population here in Iowa. Kay Puttick has an important story to report and share with us on now that is in keeping with the health of our natural resources.
Thank you, Cynthia. Recently, the Iowa Farmers Union, or IFU, along with the Pesticide Action Network, PAN, have asked the Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship, IDALS, to improve its reporting and response process around pesticide application. The coalition, which is led by the Iowa Farmers Union, is also requesting enhanced agency support for farmers who experience losses from pesticide drift. And to talk about this, I'd like to introduce and welcome our next guest, Gabrielle Roche McNally. Gabrielle, welcome again to Local Talk.
Thanks for having me.
Gabrielle, I believe you're here as a representative of the Iowa's Farmers Union, which I believe is the oldest organization of its type in Iowa.
Yes, the Iowa Farmers Union actually started in 1915, and is actually the oldest farm organization in the state of Iowa. And we really have been working on behalf of small and large independent family farms, farmer-owned cooperatives, and really just healthy and sustainable farm communities in the state of Iowa.
And it's your 100th year anniversary, I believe.
Yes. This November, actually, we'll be celebrating our 100-year anniversary during our annual convention. Our annual convention happens yearly, and it's where our members come together and help develop our policy priorities for the upcoming year. But we also revisit our policy documents and really think about grassroots development of what we want to see happen in the farm community every year.
Yeah, and we'll be talking more about that, of course. But I'd like to focus in on this petition, first of all. I believe you filed it this last December with the Iowa Department of Agriculture asking for new rules around pesticide application. And I just want to ask you, tell us a little bit about this process of this petition and when you expect a response.
Yeah, well, I might just back up for a moment and explain kind of how this came about.
Mm-hmm.
It really has come about from the last year plus of work. It started really with some work that Practical Farmers of Iowa have done, specifically Liz Colby there. She put together a summary of public record based on Pesticide Bureau case files for alleged spray drift. to organic fruit and vegetables and horticultural crops. And that kind of started the conversation. IDOLS does collect information about people who've been spray drifted on. However, it's not a very public process. It's very difficult to get access to this information. It is public, but actually Liz had to go in and sit in their office and sift through these different reports and put together a public record of this in an accessible form. So it's actually on the Practical Farmers of Iowa webpage. And so I encourage people who want to dig into that. Just for a little reference, just in 2014, we've had 67 incidences of pesticide drift, and over the last 4 years, almost 400. So that's what kind of got us started on the conversation about pesticide drift. And as we gathered with this information from PFI, Pesticide Action Network started to get on board, and they've made it a priority nationwide and actually internationally to look at issues of pesticide impacts to communities. And Iowa Farmers Union has listened to a number of our members who have experienced drift and recognize that, you know, this is something that is actually discouraging the growth of a diversified agriculture mm-hmm. in Iowa, and specifically farmers that we work with.
Can you give us an example? Because I live in an urban environment and I don't understand this.
Before I came to Iowa, I wouldn't know what pesticide drift was.
Can you give us an example of how this would affect somebody that you know of?
Yeah, I probably won't use names for the radio. These stories are actually quite, I would say, controversial. They're quite emotional for the people who go through them. You're welcome to look at the summary of public record, and actually goes through names, but I'll just generally tell you kind of the gist of some of the stories that I've heard, okay. Because it's a very emotional thing. A lot of people are impacted by their neighbors. So we have farmers, you know, drift happens to lots of farmers. So it's not just organic producers or vegetable producers, orchard growers. We have commercial gardens. We have just conventional non-GMO crops that are also affected by drift. So it's a diverse group of people who are impacted by pesticide drift. But typically, the worst sort of impacts are from aerial applications of pesticides. So typically, you're intended to spray when the conditions are right in the weather. However, as you know,
there's not much wind and so on.
Correct.
To blow it around.
Correct. And unfortunately, because, well, fortunately or not, there's so much acreage of corn and soybean primarily, which is mostly the target crops here. And there's a kind of small windows to get in there and actually spray the crops when needed, when the weather's right, when the wind's right. So certainly there are lots of applicators who are very responsible and follow the rules and regulations outlined by IDOLS. But there are, of course, incidences where the weather is not right and people go up to spray and because of the wind conditions. But there's also some underlining work that, say, Pesticide Action Network has done in terms of looking at the volatility of certain pesticides that make it them more susceptible to drift.
And also, I mean, sometimes it's just your neighbor, you know, you can sort this out with your neighbor, but there are repeat violators.
So,
and it's very difficult for farmers. Granbrier was explaining how long it took them to gather all these statistics. It's very difficult for farmers to process the complaint process, I mean, to put it simply. And if you're a small or beginning farmer, it can destroy you to have pesticide drift.
I'm still trying to wrap my head around it. What happens to people or animals that are exposed to these pesticides would cause you guys to come together to make this a little more public?
Yeah, so for example, for a few of our farmers, primarily fruit and vegetable producers, they'll experience some amount of drift. Now, it does happen that the actual pesticides get on people's bodies and affect them physically, but what I'm going to focus more on here is crops. So it can impact your crops.
Okay.
So if you can spray onto some portion of your cropland or
okay,
potentially
so like,
you if you're working in the field.
So people that, say, have crops that are not pesticide resistant, say like grapes.
Mm-hmm.
Grapes are not pesticide resistant. So these vineyards that you see growing up around Iowa, the Roundup will actually kill them.
Yeah, and even if you're growing corn, it might not be Roundup-ready corn. So it can affect corn growers.
Like
fruit and vegetables, mostly.
Fruits and vegetables,
mainly,
fruits and vegetables, orchard crops, apiaries, it impacts.
So it'll kill bees.
Mm-hmm. So that's there. Anything kind of on a sensitive crops registry. But what happens typically is within pesticides, you have a target set of crops that they're supposed to be used for. So if anything is off label, you run into an issue where that crop, say it's tomatoes, something that's happened in Iowa, if it gets sprayed by a non-target pesticide, it may never be able to be consumed by people. Sometimes there's a window of time at which you can wait for the pesticide residue.
So it has to actually filter out naturally through the thing, but it could be actually contaminated, the pesticide permanently.
And a lot of our producers have crops that they just choose not to sell. So if you're certified organic, if you have greater than 5% residue, you typically can't sell your crop as organic, and some folks have lost their organic certification based on drift incidences.
Which it takes years to get organic certification, and you lose it because of one incident of drift.
So these pesticides also affect the natural wildlife, too. They kill off habitat for butterflies, and they kill off habitat for other animals. So what other species besides the farmers that are affected? I mean, where does it go into the natural environment where people are upset about it?
You know, I mean, that's definitely not an area that we directly focus on with Iowa Farmers Union, but from my knowledge, it certainly has an impact on what the conversation Iowa's been about, sort of prairie strips and buffers. And so anything that is not targeted for that, say Roundup, but there are lots of other herbicides and pesticides used in the state of Iowa that impact those natural areas where that can be a refuge for monarch butterflies, other insect species, as well as birds and whatnot. So it certainly is something that affects the state of Iowa generally and the wildlife that's here. I know less about the impacts to mammals and whatnot.
Well, just the word drift, that's what I'm thinking. If it's affecting farmers that are right next door to these corn crops and soybean crops, and then you have habitat next to them and other farms, it's not just going to affect the farmer that's next door. It's going to affect all the property and all the habitat surrounding the whole farm.
Right.
So it's not just a cash crop issue too. It's all the infrastructure and natural resources that surround it. Yeah, Pat, you have something?
Yeah, I might point out when they spray for the spider mites, it does negatively impact birds. It does kill songbirds, that dicistinate that they like to use. And we're going down that road of better living through chemistry. So the issues that are current today, a few years from now, it might be something else. It just keeps evolving and growing and growing. And when they don't keep track, you know, when there's no means to designate a certain area and there is drift, then you've got problems.
Yeah, and these things that we've been hearing, I mean, since we started talking about wildlife, death, disappearance almost, feared extinction of monarch butterflies, and what do they call it, hive death or hive collapse. Farmers have, as I said, been destroyed. You know, if you're a beginning farmer and you're starting up, pesticide drift and you lose your organic certification, that can finish you.
So, yeah, actually, I was just speaking with a farmer at the Practical Farmers of Iowa Conference, and actually he's an Iowa Farmers Union member as well, and he was impacted as an organic producer. This is quite a few years ago by drift and fought it in the court. So what happens generally, IDALS and their pesticide bureau, they're very good at coming out to your farm and testing. So they'll come out and wherever you believe there's been drift impacting your crops, your clothes, they will take samples and they're very quick about that. So there's been a lot of public support for what they've done there. But the problem is this turnaround with the lab testing to find out what's actually impacted your crops. So often we don't know exactly what pesticide has been used. And then the farmer has to make the decision of whether or not they can sell that crop. And so sometimes it can take literally months, 4 to 6 months for them to get the test results back. And I think incidents even more than that at points. And really, IDALS can levy a fine to negligent spray drifters, but that doesn't go to the farmers who've been impacted. If a farmer's been impacted and wants to file a suit and litigate for money to get back based on their damages, they can do that. But as anyone who's gone through a legal process, you know, it's quite a large process, a long process, and there are no sort of certainties regarding that. So there's very little recourse for farmers who've been impacted, and the onus is on them to litigate. And so why Farmers Union has gotten involved is, you know, for one, can we improve the process at the Pesticide Bureau level to ensure that farmers have more support at the outset, so they're aware of their rights. We have more transparency on the website based on what farmers can do if they've been impacted by drift. Also, we would like to see a searchable database where farmers and the community at large can get a better sense of what pesticides are being applicated and where. So applicators have to keep track of what they're spraying, but that's not necessarily something that is publicly available. And then we'd like to increase the turnaround time for the lab results, or create a fund that would help people get a private lab results if they're unable to do it through the state in a timely fashion. Part of our job is just to try to improve the access and support that farmers who have been drifted on, because this is something that sort of really impacts a more diversified agriculture in the state of Iowa.
So as farmers go more local crops and more organic, and they try to keep it as clean as possible, these impacts by the pesticide drift occur, and it devastates their crop because they can't be certified as organic, and it poisons what they're trying to do.
It doesn't just affect, sort of vegetable producers or small farms. I mean, there are actually a growing number of people who are planting non-GMO conventional corn and soybean in the state of Iowa. It also has an impact on them as well. I mean, usually it doesn't impact the entire farm, so usually people are able to salvage a crop, but it certainly has cost upwards of millions of dollars for some vegetable producers with high-value crops such as asparagus or whatnot. So it can certainly, and there are stories of people who've given up on their farms because it's simply been too difficult to deal with the impacts of drift.
Are these in very specific locations, this drift happening? Is it occurring over and over and over?
I couldn't tell you if there are specific areas that have been hit more often than others.
Because the information is out there and you can't access it.
You can, I don't think that the report that Liz Colby and Practical Farmers of Iowa put together has a map, but they do sort of span, it does span the whole state of Iowa. So this is something that's happening everywhere. But certainly there are areas where we might have more diversified agriculture that's impacted more.
Is that what you hope to achieve, is maybe anybody could understand where this is happening?
Yes, make a whole thing more transparent and make the process easier to navigate. And also, I believe, for farmers that have been impacted, to give them some recompense easily, quickly, and to have a deterrent effect for repeat offenders, of which there are a few.
Correct. Yeah. So I think it's important, since we are a farmers organization, we're not out to get all pesticide applicators. We're really focusing on negligent spray drift, right? We're focusing on what we call the bad actors, people who have, not followed the rules for applying during certain weather events, and people who have repeat offenses. And so there is a graduated scale of fines for repeat offenders, but we're talking about increasing that. And the other piece that we're asking for is to increase the insurance that applicators carry because of the high-value crops that can be lost. We're asking them to increase their insurance rates so that they can cover the impacts to, vegetable producers who lose hundreds of thousands of dollars in a crop.
Mm-hmm. And going back to my first question, when do you expect a response to your petition?
So what we're actually encouraging people to do, and I'll put a plug in here now, is we're actually asking folks to submit comments to IDALS and the Pesticide Bureau. So you can actually email Margaret Thompson at IDALS, margaret.thompson@iowaagriculture.gov. And we encourage you to copy Jana Linderman, who is our president of Iowa Farmers Union, jlinderman@iowafarmersunion.org.
And we will put these names and contacts on our website.
And we're asking people to talk about whether or not they're worried about pesticides drifting onto your farm, if you've been farmers who have impacted by drift. And I also encourage people who are in agricultural communities who are worried about drift, more generally speaking. Obviously, other states have gotten some more stronger rules against drift, specifically around communities and schools and households. So it's not something that just affects farmers and farm producers, but rural communities in general, anywhere pesticides are being sprayed. So we encourage people to submit comments. We should know, they're set to make the rule respond to us within the month, I believe. I don't actually have the Thursday, February 5th is our deadline to submit comments. And in addition to that, we encourage folks, if they're interested, not just in this issue, but more broadly speaking on local foods, we're putting together legislation on local foods and drifts, there are some issues that can't be addressed by the rule change through IDOLs. So we're actually we have legislation that's being drafted in the Senate on pesticide drift, and then we also have legislation that's being drafted on local foods specifically in the House, and it's a bipartisan bill. And so maybe just to tie it back around that really I think doing work on pesticide drift is a way for us to support local foods and the growth of a more diversified agricultural system in Iowa. So that's kind of the heart of what we're doing.
I believe, I don't know how important this is, but one part that you're asking for is that people that want to spray give 48 hours advance notice to farmers.
Right. And we've tried.
It wasn't clear to me what they could do with that advance notice, but maybe that's a bit too complicated to go into.
Right. At least to have a little bit more leeway, especially because some people, if they're out in their field, they and their dogs and any other animals can try to go inside. And the other thing that we've tried to promote, I know some of our Iowa Farmers Union members have worked on this in the past, is to promote people to sign up on the sensitive crop registry. So before you apply, applicators are required to check that list and see if there are sensitive crops in the region. Unfortunately, I think that the sensitive crop registry is underutilized by sensitive crop producers, apiaries and whatnot, orchards. You know, not everyone is signing up. And so that's one level of protection. And it also gives us a better sense of how many sensitive crops are out on the landscape. So it's good for transparency and record keeping, but also it should be some protection for producers who want to make sure that the applicators in their area know what crops are in the region.
I'm scared we'll run out of time before you have a chance to mention your lobby day.
Yeah. So, and then finally, kind of our big day that we put together every year is the Iowa Farmers Union Lobby Day. It's February 3rd. We're starting at 11 a.m. at the Iowa State Capitol. We're meeting in the cafeteria there. If folks are interested, they can actually email Deborah Bunka, who's our membership coordinator, at dbunka@iowafarmersunion.org. Or you can just go to our website, iowafarmersunion.org. and find out more information. But I encourage anybody who's interested in the political process. It's quite a fascinating process, and you actually typically get a lot of face time with legislators. And last year was the first year I'd done it in Iowa, and I had a really wonderful experience talking with people across partisan lines about the issues that are our priorities. And I can tell you there's a huge amount of support on both in the Republicans and the Democrats for local foods development. And I think pesticide drift is connected because we need to address that in order to have a vibrant local foods situation in Iowa.
Thank you. Thank you
very much, Gabrielle.
You are listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events here in central Iowa. Thank you, Kay Puttick, for bringing in Gabrielle Reish McNally. Hope I got the name correctly, from the Iowa Farmers Union, and talking about pesticide drift. Thank you, Pat Schlarbaum, for bringing in the Eagles.
My pleasure.
Appreciate that. You know, there is a connection with both of those, dealing with pesticides and habitat. So, if you do have, questions, contact, the Iowa Farmers Union for more information on how you can get involved. As you well know, Ferguson, Missouri, a suburb of St. Louis, is where Michael Brown Jr., an 18-year-old black man, was fatally shot by Darren Wilson, a 28-year-old white Ferguson officer. The disputed circumstances of the shooting and the resulting protests and civil unrest nationally and the scrutiny of U.S. law enforcement practices internationally sparked a vigorous debate about law enforcement's relationship with African Americans and police policies of force used in the St. Louis area and nationally in other municipalities as scrutiny of law enforcement became front page news. Jasmine Marca, intern at KHOI, interviewed two Iowa State students from Ferguson, Missouri, to share their experiences growing up in the community. Jared Ingram is a junior studying kinesiology, and Kendra White is a senior studying chemistry, and they both run for the Iowa State track team. Here is that interview.
Mike Brown, a black teenager from Ferguson, Missouri, a suburb of St. Louis, was shot and killed on August 9th of 2014 by police officer Darren Wilson. Brown's body was left lying in the middle of the street for 4 hours, while crowds of people gathered questioning why the police allowed this. Confusion and anger stirred up in the community, and this was quickly picked up by social media and news outlets. Peaceful protests rose out of this devastating event to raise awareness for the amount of police brutality occurring in St. Louis. Both Jared and Kendra happened to live close by to where this incident happened. When I first met with Kendra and Jared, I really just wanted to give them a chance to speak about their communities and to give us all an insight into the deeper problem of these rising police brutality issues. The Ferguson Movement stemmed from the frustration of its citizens. The Ferguson Movement challenges those in power and demands justice for the numerous deaths caused by police brutality. As mentioned by both students in the following clips, there needs to be a systematic change in our nation's justice system. I also wanted to give Jared and Kendra a chance to share with the Ames community what Ferguson really is like, because this past December, Iowa State students showed support by having a peaceful protest on campus and demonstrating a dine at Parks Library. These student protesters received a lot of positive feedback, but unfortunately, there were some students who didn't agree with the student protests and lashed out on social media.
Growing up in Ferguson was just fine. Like, me and my sister could walk up to the park when I was in sixth grade and she was second grade. And we can just go together to the park. Like, we didn't need adult supervision. You would see a lot of kids walking up and down the street going to, like, the convenience stores, you know, riding their bikes, whatever. It's very peaceful community. Rarely do you ever see any, like, violence or whatever.
What type of things does your community do, I guess, for fun or even just, like, on a normal basis?
Block parties.
Okay.
Depending on what street you live on, sometimes the community has a block party. It's either they barricade off the block or they'll have it at somebody's house, or we'll walk up, everybody goes to the park, and then, you know, you just bring your barbecue, you bring, you know, your chips, whatever, and everybody just hanging out. Or sometimes they, we have like little meetings just to set the record straight for whatever's going on in the community and people, to let people know. It's weird, but the only one that sticks out is Chasing the Bomb Pop Man. Because, like, I don't know how it is in other communities, but like our Bomb Pop Man, he would, that's the ice cream man, by the way, he would play, like music that's on the radio. Like, he wouldn't play that, you know, da da da. He would play like actual music that's on the radio. Mm-hmm. So just chasing him down and, you know, him giving us ice cream, that was pretty funny.
I want to say, like, as a place that I grew up, that it's always been a place that's been pretty diverse. There's been a lot of good people that impacted my life growing up there, as far as my parents and teachers, mentors, coaches. So I don't want people to see this as a place that has been, like, left in ruins, like, after this happened, or that it's a place where people don't have any discipline and don't know how to control themselves. But I also want them to know that the things that happened weren't without a cause, that it's a problem that I've seen occur on multiple occasions. Like, it's not just a couple people that were out of control. So I would hope that people would be able to realize, like, this is something that you need to continue to work to get policies and things put in place that will prevent the unjust things happening from the justice system that's supposed to be there and hired to protect and serve the people. I would say a very good experience, like, growing up. My parents had me and my sisters in private school all the way up until my sophomore year of high school, and then my sophomore year I switched over to the local, like, public school, mm-hmm. which is McClure High School, and that's where I graduated from. So it was a little different there, just like, it's like you're exposed to a little bit more than being in private school. My probably best memory of being in Ferguson was probably actually would come whenever I started running track, and I actually switched schools because my private school didn't have a track team. So, like, when I started running track and I met my coach there, Coach Walbrink, and, like, just meeting him and, like, the close, like, community that we had as far as, like, a team, like, I'd never really been part of a team that was close like that, and that we achieved stuff together just because we were so close and we all were willing to work hard because we all had the same goals. So, I mean, that's probably some of my best memories have been, like, at track meets, practicing with them. Like, that's probably one of the best experiences I've had with a sports team. was running there at McClure High School.
Jared shares how he felt the moment he found out what happened with Mike Brown, and why it was this moment that received a lot of attention, despite this not being the only time police brutality has occurred in St. Louis.
I was upset just because this isn't like the first time that something like this has happened. Like, police brutality has been a ongoing problem in the city of St. Louis, and not even just in Ferguson, but in St. Louis as a whole. So I felt like, even though I didn't know every detail, I just felt like there was enough questioning in what happened that he should have at least been indicted. And it just happens over and over again where officers do this and there's no consequences. They just automatically, I guess, take their word for whatever happened. There's no, like, further investigation as opposed to what would lead up to an indictment. And they're usually just let off and there's no consequences. So it's frustrating.
So this is obviously not the first time.
It's happened a lot of times before.
And what do you think maybe made this particular moment bigger than what?
I think just because of, like, the sheer amount of times that it's happened, it's just, like, tension that builds until eventually it's like the straw that broke the camel's back. Eventually something's going to give. Mm-hmm. And I think this was that one moment. What made this moment to be that specific moment, I don't know. But I guess it just happened to be at the right time where people just retired and couldn't take any more of it.
Kendra did participate in the Ferguson protests back in August. She shares with us her experience.
It was good to see everybody coming together, not just from Ferguson, but from all over. Like, there were people coming from out of state, like, to come and protest with us. And so that was a good feeling to see everybody out there in support. But then I felt hurt when his mom was out there. And as soon as they introduced her, she could do nothing but cry. Like, she couldn't even say thank you all for coming. Like, she just started crying. And, you know, people just showed her love and, you know, embraced her, gave her hugs and everything. But I felt for her because I just feel like no parent should have to watch their child lay in the street for 4 hours lifeless. Like, it makes me speechless. Like, I just don't understand how that could happen.
Jared gives us his insight on how these protests and riots were seen by the public. He also mentions how individuals, specifically on social media sites, called out the people who participated in the riots that broke out during one of the peaceful protests.
Media portrayed it as just like, you know, this happened and then everybody just erupted into, like, violence and, like, everybody was burning stuff down and looting buildings. Like, that stuff did take place, but that was the minority of people. The majority of the people down there were there to protest, you know, which is, you know, a right that we have mm-hmm. to protest. You know, some people out here that go to Iowa State, I see them tweeting stuff like, you know, they're, like, acting like a bunch of wild animals and all this, and then you look back a year from a couple months from now when the Visa riots happened, and like, you see riots at, like, when Ohio State won the football game, you know, they won the national championship. They had all sorts of riots and people setting fires and stuff. And then here, this is the second year in a row where Visa people were flipping cars and stuff like that. But, you know, like, that stuff is seen as different than what was happening in Ferguson. And ours was actually, you know, the people that were doing it were in the wrong, but it was sparked by a problem that is a huge issue, not just because people were excited that we won a game or because it's Visa.
The moments these two students just shared happened right before classes commenced at Iowa State. So returning to Ames for their junior and senior year was somewhat bittersweet. And despite being in Ames, as the story behind Mike Brown's death developed, Jared and Kendra's family and friends kept them updated through various social media platforms such as Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat, and of course, through text and phone calls.
How did you feel when you left for Iowa State?
I didn't want to, especially because this time around my little sister was coming with me, and normally it would be her and my little brother at home together, and this time it's just him. And, like, just the situation that was happening, it it hurt him as well. And I could tell he was a little scared and he didn't want to be alone because he hugged me. And normally he hugs me, you know, before I go. But this time he held on for a long time. I'm like, okay, LJ, I gotta go. And he's like, but I don't want you to go. And next thing I know, he's crying. And I'm like, oh no, I really didn't want to come back. Not at that time.
Jared shared how his siblings remained active in the Ferguson movement as well.
I have a younger sister two younger sisters. One of them is a freshman at Tuskegee in Alabama, but the other one is 16 years old, and she goes to McClure High School as well. So she told me some of the stuff that they did. After the Mike Brown shooting, they had a die-in, kind of like we had in the library here. They had it in their school, and then they had a walkout where everybody, the majority of the kids, walked out and to protest, during a school day. So, little stuff like that you don't necessarily see on the news here. So those are just some of the stuff that they've told me.
Sooner or later, winter break was right around the corner. Both were anxious to be traveling back to Ferguson, and even though they were both only there for a short period, the Ferguson movement and protests were still in action. In these next clips, Jared mentions how he felt about returning home, and Kendra describes the community where she returned during winter break.
People ask me, are you afraid to go home? Are you nervous? Not at all. That's my home. That's where I grew up. So I don't see it as a dangerous place now or anything. I'm just upset with the stuff that's going on within there, and then also how we're being betrayed. But it doesn't change my view of where I live at all.
The community felt really quiet, I should say. There's still people out there, of course. But it felt quiet until there was another guy. I don't know if you heard about that. But there was another guy who got shot and killed by police. And that just sparked another uproar in the community. And I was even closer to my house. So it was kind of it was shocking. It just opened up another wound that the community was already trying to patch together.
Iowa State students also participated in a silent protest and several die-ins led by student organizations from Iowa State. A die-in is a demonstration in which people lie down as if they were dead. Here are Kendra and Jared sharing how they felt as they participated in the student-led demonstrations. Jared will also share some of the positive and negative feedback received from Iowa State students about the demonstrations held at Iowa State.
I participated in both the die-in and the march. And it just was, I guess it made me happy to see that people were supporting, the stuff that happened in Ferguson all the way here in Iowa, just because, I didn't necessarily see, Iowa as a place that would, maybe not even that they're not supportive, but just, they wouldn't really be concerned with it, just because it's not something, I guess, that it seems like is a major problem here, that a lot of things have risen up, problems from this issue that we've had in St. Louis and other places around the world. So it made me feel good to know that people were concerned about this that happened within my home and then also around the world, and that's happening to, minorities everywhere. So it definitely was a good feeling. We got both negative and positive responses. I had people come up to me and when we did the die-in, the staff at the library was very supportive. I had the librarians come up to me and tell me that they were happy that we chose the library to be a place where we were doing these demonstrations, and that if we needed anything to let them know. The chief of police from Ames actually came out and spoke to me, gave me his number, said, if there's anything that we can do for you all, just, let them know. Gave me his number and his email. And then we had some negative reactions to, why we were doing the die-in. We had some people that, walked, right through the middle of, the crowd of people, kind of in a defiant way where everybody else was just walking around. We had some people that were bumped, and when we were doing the, march, some people that were bumping into us as, we were marching. So, it was nothing that wasn't expected. I expected there to be negative and positive feedback, just because I already had seen people's responses on social media, so I knew everybody didn't agree with what we were doing.
I felt proud of my college community for recognizing that it's not just a Ferguson issue. It felt really moving to see a lot of people come out and support, because it's not just about Ferguson. It's about, like, what's happening around the world. Like it's not even just the U.S., you know? And so for people to recognize that it's an issue and to come out and support and protest with us, it felt really good.
Jared and Kendra would like to share with the Ames community, Iowa State community, and surrounding areas with these last messages about their hometown, Ferguson, Missouri.
You know, efforts are taking place in Ferguson to put it back how it was. The damage that was done to some of the local businesses, there have been multiple donors donating money and different groups rising up collecting money for Ferguson. So it's still a great place. I still love living there. I still love going home to visit.
I would just like the Ames community to know that it's, like I've been saying, it's not just a Ferguson issue. Like, it's happening around the U.S. It's happening around the world. Like, police brutality is real. It's not, to me, it's not like us black against them white. It's the system that needs to be changed. And I feel like if everybody realizes that, and they realize that it's like a nationwide, worldwide issue, then maybe we can come together a little bit more, because I still think people don't quite understand that. They think, oh, that's their problem, not it's our problem.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. That was our intern, Jasmine Marca. Jasmine Marghia, and she interviewed two Iowa State students from Ferguson, Missouri, to share their experience of growing up in that community. Jared Ingram is a junior studying kinesiology, and Kendra White is a senior studying chemistry, and they both run for the Iowa State track team, and that was their views of growing up in Ferguson and the issues dealing with that had just happened there. Up next is KHOI reporter Belinda Merritt's End of the Week Music and Entertainment Rundown.
Hello, this is Belinda Merritt with the live music report for January 30th through February 5th. On Friday, January 30th, Red Moon Harvest will be at DG's Tap, 125 Main Street. Brad Myers will be at Westtown Pub, 4518 Mortensen Road. The Craig Swalwell Band will be at The Bar, 823 Wheeler, at 9 o'clock p.m. Brian Congdon will be at Mother's Pub, 2900 West Street, at 9 o'clock p.m. On Saturday, January 31st, Nova Lab's album release party will be at DG's Tap, 125 Main Street. Gabe Dixon will be at the Maintenance Shop, Memorial Union, ISU. On Thursday, February 5th, The Kinsey Report with Dylan Boyle will be at the Maintenance Shop at the Memorial Union, ISU, at 8 o'clock p.m. And that's all I have. Thank you.
You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, 89.1 FM, Story City, Ames, where we explore the people, stories, and events here in Central Iowa. I would like to thank our guests today. Our first guest today was KHOI correspondent Pat Schlarbaum, who interviewed Bob Anderson, who is involved with the Decorah Eagles camera and how it has changed the way we experience wildlife in Iowa. Pat gave us a little bit of the phenology coming up and how you can get involved with eagles. And we do appreciate his hard work and dedication to KHOI, and he is always appreciated here. Kay Puttick's guest, Gabrielle Rush McNally, gave us a report on the issue of pesticide drift and how the Iowa Farmers Union, and along with the Pesticide Action Network, have requested that the Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship improve its reporting and response processes, as well as granting agency support to farmers who experience losses from pesticide drift. These changes in pesticide rules are meant to better protect farmers and support them with the necessary resources to deal with issues that occur with pesticide drift in our state. To hear more about these issues or the upcoming Lobby Day, which is February 3rd, contact Jana Linderman at jlinderman@iowafarmersunion.org or Kate Mendelhall, and that's Kate at panna.org, panna.org. I'd like to thank our intern, Jasmine Margia. She interviewed two Iowa State students from Ferguson, Missouri, who shared their experiences growing up in that community. Thanks goes to Jared Ingram, who is a junior studying kinesiology, and Kendra White, who is a senior studying chemistry, and they both run for the Iowa State track team. And those were insightful interviews they gave about Ferguson, Missouri. And also thanks goes out to Belinda for this week's local music lineup here in Ames and surrounding area.
Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a radio show. If you'd like to join our team as a reporter, contact us at 292-2878. That's 292-2878, or contact us through our website, khoifm.org. And of course, you're always welcome to drop by our studio in downtown Ames. If you enjoyed this show, tell your friends. Check us out on Facebook and write to us and tell us what you enjoyed. Our theme song is Always Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. You can listen to this show and all of our past local shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org. Your participation as an audience and your generous donations help make KHOI possible. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.